Morning, everybody. Good enough, I suppose. Morning. One of the sad things about being a vicar is that at Christmas time, people give you presents for your own good and for the good of the congregations that are unfortunate enough to listen to your preaching. And this Christmas, I was given a book, Information is Beautiful, and my heart sank. But actually, it's a great book, and it's packed with absolutely useless information, as well as lots of really interesting information. For example, books everyone should read, a census of all the magazines that say these are the top 10 books you should read. Don't get sucked in, get the book. It's just fascinating, it's riveting. You're all sitting there, have I read that? Oh, I've read that one. Well, what about your top 500 passwords? I don't know how they collected that, but it's a graphic of the top 500 passwords. If you could see yours there, be warned, time to change it. And then I saw something which kind of reminded me of my geography and biology lessons at school. I'm sorry I couldn't find it online. You've had to cope with a photocopy now. But this is the famous carbon dioxide cycle. It's a very simple image. The fact that the oceans, which cover 70% of the Earth, deliver about 90 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the environment, but of course they then reabsorb it. And then similarly, soil respiration, animals, and forest fires contribute 120 gigatons every year, year in, year out. And yet, that's reabsorbed by the plants. We live in perfect balance. But the problem is us. When it comes to carbon dioxide, we are shunting about 9 gigatons per year, which isn't too bad in the scheme of that cycle of 120 gigatons, but year in, year out, in 300 years since the Industrial Revolution, you can see the cumulative effect. We're gradually creating this greenhouse. Now, this isn't new to us. We've heard this many times. But another great graphic from Information is Beautiful, a graphic of what's going to happen with the rising tide levels. As you can see up the left-hand side, there's kind of centuries going by, 100 years at the bottom. We can see Venice is already in trouble. 200 years' time, at the current rate of rising of tides, 200 years' time, we'll have lost Los Angeles, Amsterdam, Hamburg, and St. Petersburg. It's almost funny. It seems so unreal, doesn't it? 200 years' time. But that's only 200 years. That's less time than we've had the industrialized world. And of course, there's many repercussions, not just rising tides. It's the implications for the world around us. And what's at fault and what the United Nations is responding to, I'm afraid, as much as all the human interest, is simply the economic side of things. Because very quickly we've identified that all that red stuff at the bottom, our human production, is having a positive effect, or a negative effect, I should say, on the world around us. And as those climate changes happen, you come all the way around the cycle until actually that's also having a negative impact on businesses. So at least, if nothing else, people are responding to the business imperative. And at this point, let's deal with another great graphic from Information is Beautiful. Is it really true? Is this just an ideology? Let's have a look at what climate change scientists, what scientists think of climate change. In fact, let's look at one of the greatest kind of climate change denier countries in the world, the United States. Let's look at their scientists. And if you want to look at that statistic there, the percentage of publishing scientists in the United States who disagree with the idea that there is human-induced climate change. Looking at those little gray figures, it's about 11% of American scientists find reason to disagree, but the other 89% are convinced. The even stronger effect, if you want to look at consensus, is on the right-hand side, the percentage of people who just specialize in the climate, whether they're biologists or chemists or geographers or engineers, the ones that have been publishing papers and articles on the climate. And then the statistic shrinks down to 1%. So when somebody says, well, do you really think that climate change is real? start to eat these things. There's also the species extinction going on. This isn't technically species, this is just the wildlife population overall since 1970. In fact, that was 2010, it's been another. I have managed to do. But what I'd really like to do is to really challenge each of us. God cares about this. I want you to be inspired about the things that you can change. It's partly we don't understand more and feel more, and partly we just haven't practiced. But if we get that sense of how important this is and how urgent it is for God's sake, then perhaps we might be inspired to do that bit more. So first of all, I want to talk about God's commission for humankind, which we heard in Genesis. I want to talk about God's passion for the health of the land. I want to talk about God's pain as well, when he sees it all go wrong. So first of all, what does the Bible say? What does the Bible say about our relationship with creation? We heard there, so beautifully read in Genesis chapter 1, right at the beginning, God's manifesto for the way things are to be, the established order, the way that the stars and the moon and they're putting governance over the nights and the nights and the days, and then the way God has then created this wonderfully diverse animal and plant kingdom. And then on day 6, where we focused in the reading, humankind is put into this position of responsibility. And the tragedy is that ever since the Industrial Revolution, I'm afraid we have to confess that the church has played its part in misinterpreting these scriptures, taking them as a mandate to move ahead and go too far, acting as mini gods, taking over authority and actually exploiting things. And it all goes wrong in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26, 28, when we talk about ruling over the land. We've taken that to mean to dominate, to subjugate, to crush. It's been given to us. Why wouldn't we do as we please with it? But when we start looking more closely, we realize it's not really as simple as that. Right back from the earliest days of translating the Bible into English, the Tyndale translation, the King James Version, you can see this kind of twofold translation, to have dominion over, to rule over. I think ever since the Bible's kind of got into our hands and out of the Latin and back into something that we can use ourselves, we started to think, aha, that means we can take over. But we need to look at the nuances behind that. And then let's look at the next bit. If you also noticed in verse 28, subduing the land, fill the earth and subdue it. And we've taken that to mean, well, that's it. We can do what we want. Just in the same way as ruling over the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, we will rule over the land. We'll get everything we can out of it. God said we could. And we've taken a very domineering view of subduing the land. But actually, if you start to look at the Hebrew and you look at what's behind it, actually modern theologians are beginning to realize we've misunderstood. That Hebrew word, kadash, is used in two ways. It's used sometimes in terms of exploiting and plundering people. Yes, it's exploiting and plundering. But there are many times through the Old Testament when kadash is used relating to land. And then the context there is working with and working alongside. see, as you look closer into the scripture, we're beginning to see a slightly more nuanced and subtle way of viewing what ruling over and subduing is. Somehow it seems to be important to God that we do take hold of this, that we do look after things. We've been put in charge, but we're not there as mini-gods, just given carte blanche to stamp over everything. Borkum summarizes like this. He says, in Genesis, subduing is to be distinguished from the dominion over other living creatures. The uniquely human practice of agriculture enables humans to multiply and spread, but the dominion granted by God presupposes that because we bear God's divine image, God can authorize us to use our superior power in a way that reflects God. We're made in the image of God, God's image bearers, to deal lovingly with the land, to deal caringly and sparingly with the land for our benefit, but not at its own loss and expense. And whereas we subdue the earth, we rule over the living creatures, again, made in the image of God, divinely, compassionately, caringly, to tend, to guard and look after the living creatures of the world. So ruling over is not permission to exploit. It's not ourselves as kind of human mini-gods taking over. And it's not that we're the central characters in creation survival. But ruling over is stewardship. It's being God's co-workers, saying, you're made in my image. I'm asking for your help in tending this creation that I see is so good. It's working within creation, not above it, not sitting above it going, well, I'm going to take what I want from that. It's working in harmony and in sync with it. Next thing I want to look at is God's relationship to the land itself. I'd like to show you that actually God really cares about the land. And right from the beginning when he chose Abraham and he chose the nation of Israel to be his chosen people, right at the beginning as he starts making these promises to Abraham, to Jacob, to Isaac, and then to Moses, God makes this connection between the well-being of the people and the way they behave and the well-being of the land. So when God is And this really comes out in the prophets. I could dwell for hours. There's 200 different quotes through the Old Testament linking Israel's behavior. When they behave well and the land is fruitful. When they behave badly and the land is tragically blighted. I'm just going to pick on one now. This is a verse from Hosea. There's no faithfulness. This is Hosea the prophet bringing God's judgment to Israel. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. And all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the fish in the sea. Well, I suggest to you, there's three aspects of my behavior which contribute, and they're all part of my need to simplify my life. And it's these. My need to consume. My need to save time and get more done. My need to do things as cheaply as possible. Just look into each of these briefly. Some of you know, I haven't talked about it much. I had a strange childhood. I was born in Japan and raised in Malaysia. It had its ups and downs. I won't get distracted by that. But a really interesting part of that was the boarding school I went to in primary school was in a rainforest. Absolute middle of nowhere, virgin jungle, absolutely incredible place. And I had the great opportunity to go back there a few years ago when the mission organization offered to pay for people to go and visit again. And several things struck me when I went back to Malaysia, which was the land of my childhood, this golden, wonderful place. And as I went up the drive where the school was, and it's still there, you could just see the destruction of the forest literally all around. Square miles turned into fruit farms. Huge logging industries decimating tracts of what had been incredibly productive, fruitful, wild forest. And then as a real microcosm, I was struck that that butterfly on the left-hand side was the national emblem of Malaysia, the Raja Brook. But now it's endangered and nearly extinct. Beautiful black and green butterfly. They're about that big, and in the sun, they're really dazzling. But what happened was, I really loved them as a kid. Them, we'll sell them. And they were very good. They could bring them in by the thousand. Not just Raja Brook butterflies, but actually any butterflies they could find and mount them, to the extent that basically they stripped the rainforest of these butterflies to the point that now particularly this species is highly, highly endangered. It's a simple little story, but it's a microcosm of our need to consume. We see, we desire, we see, yeah, I've seen that on someone else's wall. I want that. And someone else the other side of the world says, well, I can offer that. I need the money. You need the product. And before you know it, things have spiraled and we've caused an imbalance. And this is just a butterfly population. You extrapolate that to every resource under the sun, and you can see the effect that we're having. What about my needs to save time, to get more done, to be effective, to cram it all in? In our rush to get more done, perhaps in our rush to keep up with what everyone else is doing, have we taken our eyes off the effect that we're having on the world around us? A couple of topical things in my life. Up on the top right-hand side, scrambled egg mix. We do fair share. There's a lovely charity that comes into the church once a week with stuff that's past its sell-by date on the shelves. And I was glad that scrambled egg mix was off the shelves and gone past its sell-by date, partly because I did feed it to my puppies. But also, I just thought, what a stupid idea, that carton, that plastic lid, all for the sake of, what, 30 seconds in the supermarket to say, I'll get some milk and I'll get some eggs, and maybe another 30 seconds to go to the kitchen, get them out, and mix them. A carton and a plastic lid. And all the industry that went into that for the sake of 1 minute of my time. And then over on the right, I don't know if you saw this a year or so ago, someone tweeted this. It's not a very good picture, but it's peeled oranges in plastic containers. And then someone tweeted, wouldn't it be great if nature would find a way to cover these oranges so we didn't need to use so much plastic? And actually, it went viral, and pretty soon they kind of removed that from the shelves. But again, what a disgraceful idea. We can't even be bothered to peel an orange anymore, and a piece of plastic is created for that one single use. I don't want to bring you down or make you miserable, but think about it. Just as you prepare your next meal, as you go to the supermarket again, you start to open your eyes and realize this single-use plastic is absolutely everywhere. And now we're learning where it goes. Again, it's a cheaper than lamb in the local butcher. But of course, it took someone to grow the lamb, to slaughter the lamb in New Zealand, to package the lamb, to get it onto a jet, to fly it across. And it's still cheaper. Hallelujah. Isn't that great? And meanwhile, the local butcher's going out of business, who's offering you admittedly more expensive lamb from 10, 20 miles away. We're literally paying for the environment by the choices we make because of our need to save money and to have more money in our pocket. The high street brands that are going down because, you know, we use door-to-door delivery. I did it this week. I'm not going to tell you what I bought because I was embarrassed. But we do it again and again because it's quick, it's easy, and we save money. But again, do we not wonder about what we're actually spending our money on? Are there ways we can make our money work twice? One for the product we need, twice for the saving on the environment. If you're clever, sometimes when you start thinking about it, you can make your money work two, three, or four times with the benefits. But we don't. We say, let's just make it work as cheaply as possible so we get what we need now. Simplify. 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 Why do we find it so hard to simplify? We do, though, don't we? We just can't help ourselves. Bottom line is, we're the root of the problem. We can point fingers at dirtier nations. We can point fingers at climate change denial nations. But the one thing we can change is ourselves, and yet we still struggle to do it. Is there hope? Can I get any more bleak? Heard this statistic, the consumption or the production of plastic bags in UK supermarkets halved in 2019. It wasn't easy, was it? But we did change our behaviour. The ozone hole, remember the ozone hole we panicked about, quite rightly? It turns out they do believe that's reforming. These things work. They can work. Turns out the annual mileage that we do in cars is going down year by year. The number of journeys we do every year is going down. I was looking at the Department of Transport statistics. Turns out the world's biggest reef, 200 miles off Belize, 200 miles long off Belize, has been taken off UNESCO's endangered site. Thanks to people spotting it, thanks to taking the necessary steps. And I know we're skeptical about China and the pollution problem, but they have taken drastic steps and drastic measures, and it does appear to be providing fruit. They've reduced their airborne particulates by an average of 32%. When America went through the same exercise in their first year, they managed about 20%. We can change. We can do things. It's worth investing in. As I said at the beginning, I don't want to point fingers. I don't want to bring... I want you to understand how important it is to God. I want you to understand how important it is for you and each other and the legacy of future generations. And I just want to encourage you to do something. I did promise at the beginning I wasn't going to give you a list of all the self-righteous things I've managed to do. You know, we love doing that. I'm so on the tip of my tongue to say, have we done this and we've done that? But I do want to give you opportunities to think about what you could do. And as already mentioned in the notices, this is proving to be quite a big Lent. The National Church of England has hit on the environment as a big issue. There's this Live Lent campaign. You can sign up to the app. It's packed with daily activities, prayers, reflections, things for families to do together every day of Lent. You can also get a daily email if a phone app's not your thing. I think we might even have some booklets as well. We've also got a board. You may have seen that on the back as you came in. You might have seen in Pew News as well. We've included those pledges as a little insert. So if you don't get to see the boards, do take one of these little leaflets that was in Pew News. They're suggestions. No one's going to watch you. No one's going to monitor you. Small, incremental, doable steps that you might be able to pick up and do. I just want to encourage you to do something. We've seen the science. We've seen the theology. We've seen what's in our hearts that's stopping us from doing more. And we've seen there is an opportunity to change. And we see that change does work. Let's pray that as God's people, we can start to show the way. I'm ashamed to say, in some cases, joining in with what people are already doing. But wouldn't it be great if we look back and say, do you remember when the church used to lag behind and now we're at the forefront? Surely as God's people, it would be great if we were the ones saying, come on, join us. This world matters. We need to take